a request from some local townships in my district around Ely. Under current law, they're currently able to levy on unorganized townships for fire. But we don't allow, under current law, counties to levy unorganized areas of the state for EMS or first responder purposes. And so they sent me a request and indicated that they have a joint powers agreement between the town of Morse, the town of Fall Lake, the city of Winton, the city of Ely, but the unorganized areas outside of the city of Ely, where about 10% of the first responder calls come from, and oftentimes they're related to activity around the Boundary Waters canoe area, there is no opportunity to levy against unorganized property. So what the bill would do is give the county permissive authority to establish a levy in unorganized townships for the purpose of first responder needs. And Mr. Chairman, I think this is probably a good idea, and I think we probably should have a broader discussion, maybe if not here, maybe in the tax committee, about maybe a statewide policy on this rather than just for this specific program at Morrison Fall Lake. So I bring the bill to the committee thinking I think we maybe you and I should have a discussion and then maybe talk with the greater committee about the idea. I guess I'm not asking that this be included in the article coming out of this division, but I think we should probably have a discussion, maybe put it out as an amendment to the omnibus bill, maybe as a broader policy, and have a discussion among the committee whether they think this is a good idea. And in the meantime, maybe we'll have some research done on how many unorganized townships there are that could potentially be subject to a levy.
Senator Bach, what I was planning on doing was with the Senate files that we're hearing today that we thought would have the interest of the full division, that we would just bring them along as Senate files and they could be offered as amendments. With regard to the unorganized, as the population declines, we're going to have more unorganized communities in rural areas, and this might be something that we should be looking at, how we deal with that. I have a number of unorganized jurisdictions that are serviced, and I think you've got something that we should have a discussion on.
I remember a number of years ago I carried a bill when I was over in the House for Cook County that allowed them to pool. They were allowed to levy under current law for transportation for road purposes, and unorganized areas generally don't have a lot of property in them, and the money at the time had to be spent they levied in the current unorganized township had to be spent in the organized township, in the unorganized township. And I created for them an opportunity to be able to pool the money in unorganized townships so that they could get a project done in one of them rather than have to be spent in the one that it was levied in. So there are some unique issues, I think, in unorganized townships, and I think giving the counties some flexibility is probably a good discussion for us to have. And I think maybe we should, down the road here, if we don't do something this year, we should maybe engage the AMC and see what their interest is in a little broader participation in helping fund some of these things that everybody benefits from.
And I think, Senator Bach, from my recollection of my time on a county board, is the county board would recess, come back together as the board of the unorganized townships, and then do the actions that affected those areas. So I think we might be able to figure out how that would work through and see if they couldn't do something. Questions, members? So with that, Senator Bach, let's lay Senate File 3579 over, and we'll send that along with the property tax article as an amendment to be offered in full committee.
Thank you. And if somebody representing the AMC is interested, or Association of Townships is interested in discussing this, I think there's a broader policy issue here that might make some sense for us to have a discussion about. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bach. Well, second. Senator Lori, just hold on. There's a couple of people that have time constraints on Senator Larson's bill, Senate File 3207. I don't think either one of Senator Larson's bill are going to take a long time. If that would be okay with you, we'd move to Senator Larson's bill, Senate File 3207 first, and then we'll do Senate File 3566. And is anybody here from the MAC? Don't know. Senator Larson.
3207, okay. Actually.
3207.
Got some folks will be joining me here, Mr. Chair. Senate File 3207 relates to the what is known as the 60-day rule. And hello. Judge Krause. Excuse me, Mr. Chair and members. This bill would amend, as I said, the statute that's known as the 60-day rule that provides for dismissal in tax court regarding property tax assessment challenges. And we had a discussion regarding this issue last year as it resulted from a provision that was in the tax bill that Representative Marquardt had carried in the conference committee. And we're back here to have the discussion here again for consideration yet this session. With that, I'm going to turn it over to folks who can bring us up to date on how we got here. And I believe we're going to start with
Judge Krause.
With Judge Raymond Krause, who's the former chief judge of the tax court.
Mr. Krause.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm Ray Krause, and I am currently the Chief Administrative Law Judge for the state of Minnesota. However, that is not the capacity in which I am here today. I'm here in the capacity of being a former tax court judge and former Assistant Commissioner for Tax Policy for the Department of Revenue. I would preface what I say by saying merely that my opinions today are my own personal opinions and don't reflect the Department of Revenue or OAH or the tax court as it's currently constituted. What I mostly would like to address is the issue of the automatic sanction of dismissal for failure to comply with the 60-day rule. As a matter of essential fairness, it troubled me in dealing with these cases as a tax court judge when a relatively slight omission or error in providing the material required under the 60-day rule, especially then before the bill that Senator Larson referenced that has passed cleaned up some of the definitional issues. There was confusion over what data was required. And when someone innocently made a mistake or was legitimately confused over what they were supposed to have provided, the only recourse the tax court had was to automatically dismiss the petition. And that is a relatively harsh, I think you would agree, penalty to pay for what in some cases was a innocent and relatively minor problem or omission. There are cases, however, where the petitioner simply is trying to avoid providing material to the county assessor that the county assessor needs to make an adequate assessment. And in those cases, I think dismissal, where it's intentional and obstructive in nature, is warranted. And I think what this bill does is give the court the discretion to determine when it's a willful violation that is purely for delay or obstruction, in which case the court would then have the ability to impose the sanction of dismissal, as opposed to a relatively unsophisticated taxpayer who has made a best effort but in some respect has missed the target slightly, and the judge can impose a penalty such as excluding some information or allowing the county additional time to review the information after the 60-day rule expires. Those kinds of things the court could fashion to be a little bit more equitable, and recognizing the fact that the current status, to get into Gilbert and Sullivan, but the punishment doesn't fit the crime in all cases. And I think this would allow the flexibility for the tax court to use its judgment, which is, after all, why they're there, to determine what the right penalty is in each case. So that is my comment on this, and I hope that's helpful. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Judge Krause. That sounds like a reasonable direction. You have other...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to reiterate Myron Franz at Fagrian Benson supporting the Bar Association on this draft. As we all know, the right to challenge taxes is a fundamental right, and to take it away in this fashion is just very unusual. There, you just don't find this type of a penalty in any other kind of civil action where someone files a proper petition or a claim and they begin the process. And the judges, especially with Chief Judge Krause here to testify, the judges have all the authority they need under Rule 37 to sanction a taxpayer if they fail to provide the necessary information in a timely fashion. And in my experience in front of the current judges in the tax court, they know that rule very well and they will apply it if necessary. And it just seems like this is such an unfair situation for both for-profit companies and for tax-exempt companies. I'd like, if the chair has time, to hear Christina Cook from the Legal Aid Society mention the problems that pro se taxpayers have had, particularly onerous for pro se. But it's onerous for everyone to try to figure out and try to guess, excuse me, what all information is required. And as the bill that Senator Larson has proposed would provide the court with full authority to deal with the issue under whatever rulings it needs to and under its discretion, which I think we have to give the judges discretion to do this. This is not something that comes up in some cases, but I'm sure that anyone who's going to testify against this rule would realize that it's cast such a wide net that everyone potentially is caught. It just is unfair. Any other questions you have, Your Honor?
Thank you.
Mr.
Question,
Chairman.
Members? Let's see if there's anybody that wishes to testify against Senate File 3207. Mr. May.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom May. I'm the Hennepin County Assessor. I'm also a member of the Legislative Committee for the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. Our position on this bill, of course, is that we'd oppose this bill. The 60-day rule historically has been a rule that allows assessors to gain the information we need to analyze properties and determine whether there's an issue with the value or not so that we can proceed in a timely manner. I think one thing is clear here is that the tax court's a little different than other civil litigation. The tax court was set up specifically to deal with these type issues, and I think it's always been the legislature's intent that these issues can be remedied quickly and move forward because we're talking about tax base and refunds of taxes that are already levied. So the 60-day rule was put in place to give assessors that ability to get that information in a timely manner and make a determination. If we look at the history of the 60-day rule, I don't think it's a pro se issue. We are very careful with pro se litigants. We don't move for dismissal on those unless there's a refusal to provide information on their part. And in that regard, I'm talking from Hennepin's perspective because those are the cases we deal with. And I think that even on the other issues, if it's simply a small issue that we're dealing with, we will ask the taxpayer for that. If you look at the 60-day cases that have gone through our tax court and through to the Supreme Court, I would say if you read those carefully and found out the information involved, you'd find that most of those, almost all of them, are self-inflicted. There's been some refusal on the part of the petitioner to provide information. And without the information, assessors can't draw, you know, a conclusion on the value and proceed. The other thing is last year we worked with the legislature to draft some language to better define exactly what was required under the 60-day rule. We did have a bill that was introduced. It was in the tax bill that was vetoed, and it came back this year in the tax bill and has been signed by the governor. So even the bill that's in front of you does not have the correct language that's now in place. So I would urge that we at least let that language work, see how that works for all parties involved, and not change it before that's a chance to
And so, Mr. May, what Judge Krause said about the relatively minor offense resulting in the person losing all their rights doesn't happen. Am I hearing you say that?
From my experience, the dismissals that we've proceeded on in most of the court cases, if you read them or I can discuss them with you if you'd like, I don't think they're minor offenses that have occurred. That may have happened somewhere. I'm not testifying that it hasn't. But in most cases, there's something that hasn't been provided that's caused it to move forward through dismissal. Technically, in Hennepin County, I can tell you that if the petitioner provides information and there's something missing, we'll send them a letter and ask them for that missing piece of information. But if you do read the court cases again, one, for example, that was dismissed and went to the Supreme Court, it had to do with leases on a shopping center. And basically, the petitioner would not provide those leases and told the assessor to go to California if they wanted to look at them. So, I mean, if you look at the cases, there's usually something there that caused that dismissal to occur.
Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Bach, what would you think if I'd kind of intended to have Senator Larson's bills track along the same path that your St. Louis County levy, and we'd continue this discussion in the full division or full committee instead of because it won't make the article today unless
well,
we put
we've
it
got
in,
some,
and it doesn't sound like it's ready to go yet.
We've got some time to schedule it in the full committee. Say that without talking to staff, but I got some time Tuesday next week. Probably we could add it on.
Senator Larson, I think I heard Mr. May say that there's some language changes that would have to, because of the law that we passed this a couple weeks ago or whenever it was, that'll have to be done. And maybe we should listen to what the assessors are saying a little bit here and see if we get a better understanding, and we'll continue this discussion in the full tax committee. Would that be all right with you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's a good idea. I've had a couple of people have approached me this morning to ask to have maybe get everybody around the table and have more of a discussion. So I'd be happy to coordinate that and see what we can bring back to the committee next week.
Senator Bach.
That would be helpful before we are in the full committee if really broach the subject before we get there and hear that. Like we've made the system work a little better.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Larson.
Do you want me to continue or?
Well, let's wait on your other bill, I think. You're on the committee, so yeah. let's wait on it. Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've got Senate file 3639 before you. I guess I need to start with a statement that it's a little awkward coming before carrying a bill calling for imposing additional penalties on certain delinquent property taxes in a time when over the last several months I don't believe there's been a paper in our state that hasn't highlighted front page, top of the fold, our foreclosure crisis. And so I need to say, first off, what this bill is not intended to do, and it is not intended to exacerbate the problems for people who are truly struggling to pay their property taxes, which admittedly are rising at an alarming pace. What this is intended to do, I'll give you a little bit of background. I've gotten a few calls from constituents and actually have some personal experience with this as well. There are instances where individuals who own property, particularly in rural areas, I believe, are simply not paying their taxes as a float to use the money for the full 7 years and just paying in the seventh year. And it gets to be a little bit of a frustration for some county auditors, I know. And it's a frustration for people who are struggling very hard and meeting their obligations. And I think that it puts a little bit of additional burden on those folks who are really trying to play by the rules. And so what this is an enabling statute where if the county auditor finds that it's really an intentional abuse of the property tax system to just use that money for a bit longer and that it is not due to any financial constraints by the individual, they would have the option to then pursue some additional penalties in such an instance. There is a abatement option in the statute. I will say, I dropped this hoping to stimulate some discussion. I haven't done a great deal of work myself to get that discussion going, but I have not heard from anybody either in support or in opposition to this, truthfully, other than the few individuals who have called me. I'll say in my personal experience, too, I've been living in my area since I was a little kid, and it's kind of an annual event when the property tax delinquent statements are published in the newspaper and we all look at them. I pull out the plat book and actually find out where they are. I go do drive-bys, sometimes just to see where these folks are. And a lot of the ones that we're talking about are people who don't live in the area. They're absentee owners, and you see them year after year after year after year, and the exact extent of how much of it is truly intentional, I find hard to say. But I thought it's worthy of a discussion whether the county auditors would find this a useful tool in helping to ensure compliance with our property tax statutes, and one that would give some degree of comfort to those who are working so hard to comply.
Thank you, Senator Laurie. I think that Mr. Hagan or Mr. Folkman, Mr. Hagan from the department is going to provide some additional information on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Hagan, Assistant Director with the Property Tax Division. And I don't at any level pass myself off as an expert on delinquent taxes, but this does concern us at the department. It appears at a quick look to create a great deal of discretionary authority on the part of the enforcing agencies. And it would seem to concern me a lot when somebody is trying to make a determination about somebody's perceived financial ability to pay taxes. So I guess our recommendation would be that we'd certainly want to take a much closer look at this before we would endorse it or recommend its passage.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan.
Thank you.
Questions, members? Senator Moore.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Laurie, to the extent that maybe we need to get you a movie theater or something so that you can stop doing the drive-bys, that would be...
It's once a year, Senator Moore. It's not...
But, Mr. Chair, I would agree with Mr. Hagan, and I thought maybe one way to do this is if your concern is about the absentee landlords, that might be a good way to kind of narrow it down, particularly if everybody kind of know who our neighbors are, and people know. I mean, particularly in your kind of neighborhood or towns where if you do know where all the properties are, if it is sort of the perennial absent folks, then maybe there's a way to kind of narrow it down with some kind of restriction.
Very happy to entertain the discussion about how to best approach this to get at the probably fairly limited number of instances that we're talking about that again cause frustration and administrative burdens at the auditor level, and just people get constituents get frustrated seeing this too. So but more than happy to listen and start a dialogue, which is what this was intending to do.
Well, Senator Lurie, I think we're going to lay Senate File 3639 over, and we'll work on it during the interim and see what we can bring back next year, okay?
Much appreciated.
Thank you, Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thanks. Senator Metzen, is the MAC in the room now? Yeah, just a comment. We're not going to hear Senate File 2277 today. Senator Larson has, I've had discussions with him. He thinks with the uncertainty in the airline industry right now, this might not be the good time. But I do have a question that I might want to visit with you at some point. So if you want to stop by, I'm interested in the issue about if there are going to be property tax ramifications if the airline industry does go way south and some of your revenue bonds fail to generate revenue, and what the result of that would be. So if where the ultimate issue lies with some of the bonding authority that's gone on at the MAC. And so if you could stop by and we'd have a visit with that, and maybe Senator Larson will join us. But we're not going to hear Senate File 2277 today, so you don't need to hang around for that. Senator Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I think this is kind of an unusual thing for this senator to come before you and ask for your help.
Right? You can't.
Remember the last time ever I've been here asking for relief from some relief from the community.
There's no water.
It's not far away.
It does have a couple of restaurants, Axel's. It does house Fairbolt House.
Yeah.
It's a Sibley House that are non tax paying buildings, of course. And our LGE is right about $1,000 a year. And they're right, I think you all know, right over the middle of the bridge.
Part of it, I shouldn't say this,
but part of the village looks like kind of a war zone down there. And, you get back behind the main street.
They just don't
have any tax capacity to do the infrastructure, put in streets and roads, and it's just it's an unusual little town in the metropolitan area. I can't think of any like it. I've been,
you know, around here for 60
years. I've been in all the region. I shouldn't say how many years. Case that this is unique, and I know we're in tough times around here, but they get, I think, $1,050 or something, and they just can't do anything.
They have a couple restaurants that
pay taxes, there's a VFW club, and maybe one business or two. But, so we're trying to make the case, and I have the city administrator here to help. But, again, I don't come here lightly.
Well, Senator Metzen, we'll hear from Ms. Olin. There are unique circumstances that the legislature has to take into account. So we're here to listen to what you have to say. And I think that as we move forward with the local government aid formula, there is going to be a redo of the formula. We want to know what these anomalies are so, you know, we can be working on them. And we'll certainly take a look and see what we can,
well,
if we can do
anything
this year.
I would really appreciate it. We have the three biggest buildings in the town are historical buildings, non-taxable buildings. I suspect the
And Senator Metzen, is this a under 2,500 population community?
Yeah.
We have struggled with the small cities formula, so we'll see what we can do there. Ms. Olin?
Again, I just want to thank you. It's interesting being on this side of the table. We are a small community. We're 164 people. This came about kind of reviewing other local government aid to other small cities, mainly rural. They seem, some of the cities, their local government aid is the majority of their budget. Our tax levy is $125,000, most of which goes to the police and fire, which we contract with Mendota Heights. So if we could just get more in keel to what the rural small cities have, because we're in the metro area, we have a lot more restrictions, a lot more obligations than the smaller cities have. So any help we could get, we'd greatly appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Senator Metzen.
I'd like to acknowledge that we have a couple of council members that took the day off because of the importance of this legislation. So they are the back of what their voters are. So try to get some help.
Yep.
Appreciate
anyway,
you.
They're in the second row right here.
Appreciate you coming this morning. Questions, members?
So I appreciate it.
Senator Metzen, we'll see what we can do this year. It's going to be a tough year for this stuff. And, you know, we did have all the city organizations working on some changes. I understand that inclusion of the jobs as an index isn't going to be real helpful, and I've looked at the runs for Mendota, and it doesn't have there's no gain from what our proposal is this year for your community. But we'll take a look at it and see what we can do. And thank you, Senator Metzen. Thanks
thank
for coming,
Ms.
Olin.
Thank you.
Senator Olson. We'll get a page. Go ahead.
Is that on?
That's on. Welcome to the Property Tax Division, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And members, this is an XXS file. Senator Olson talked to me a couple days ago, and we hurriedly got this drafted, and I told her that we'd have a hearing if we could get the language here. So. Doesn't have a number, but it will.
It will today in bill introductions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to, somewhat like Senator Metzen, in 25 years, this is the first time that I have come with a proposal in an effort to help one of my cities. I represent 20 cities in western Hennepin County, and as you were talking about the challenge of formulas. Formulas usually don't address anomalies, and often we find those. And so I do hope that you can find some ways to give some consideration. The city that this bill is regarding is the city of Excelsior, and Mayor Nick Rail is here with me. They are a unique city of a small population, less than 2,500. Less than a mile of geographic area, 0.87 tenths of a mile, 60% of which is tax exempt. The modest income, moderate income families there, and yet they're a core of heavy demand, service demands, and it's catching up. The formulas that changes over the years have been reducing the aid that they've had, and the one that you have now is just as holding harmless. At the same time that the impact of the costs and demands is increasing, I don't want them to sink off the face of the earth. So, I'm here to hope that you will be able to consider some means of relief. But I would like to have Mayor Rail address it a little bit more in depth.
Sure. And Senator Olson, what is the reason that 67% of it's off, not taxable?
60%?
60%.
I'll let him describe that.
Mayor Rail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am Nick Rail, and I'm mayor of the city of Excelsior, and really appreciate the opportunity to share with you today some of the critical information that supports our request. Rather than
did this get distributed?
I believe that the handout mm-hmm. was distributed, and I just want to make a couple of introductory comments. It's really relatively easy to paint Excelsior with the same broad brush that one might with other communities, other cities around the lake. But to do that kind of overlooks some of the real underlying issues and circumstances that over time have brought significant financial constraints to the city. And that's why I've described this as the perfect storm. Excelsior is indeed unique. We're 154 years old. We're a small city, and yet we act as somewhat of an area and regional center for parks, for the trail system. We have the affordable housing, the senior housing, the nursing home facilities. We have seven churches, school, all within this very small city. We have a cemetery as well. In addition, the LGA formulas of the past have reduced our LGA over 55%. I've tried to demonstrate in this handout, like a little graphically and with bullet points, some of the key issues. Senator Olson mentioned those. When you take the area of the city and you reduce the water, the roads, Highway 7, County Road 19, our parks, our cemeteries, our schools, and churches, we end up with, of that 8.87 square mile, we end up with very small amount of actual taxable land. Fortunately, we're using it as much as we can, but we are landlocked. So any new tax capacity comes out of redevelopment. Our housing, 55% of our housing units are multifamily dwelling. So we really do indeed act as a center and regional area. Our median income is 80% of that, which is of the median income in the metro area. Our median income is less than the median income household income for those across the state. And in particular, it's 50% of our neighboring contiguous cities. So that combined with the fact that we have we already have joint powers agreements in place relative to our fire and police. We pay an extraordinary amount, or I should say we pay in excess of our tax capacity for our policing because of the services that we require. And with our aging infrastructure and some of the things that we're facing in the future, we are looking and asking and requesting some additional LGA. So that's the brief story, and I'm certainly willing to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Questions for Senator Bach?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mayor, what percentage of your city's population are considered retired? Just curious what the kind of the
I think we're
of the
we're about retired is probably 25 to 28%. What we have is a very diverse population. Interestingly, we have a very diverse population because of our affordable housing. So not only is our multifamily housing, the idea of it being seniors, but it has a very diverse population as well. 48% of our housing units, including single family, are considered affordable under the Met Council guidelines.
And Mr. Mayor Real, could you help me? What is that definition of affordable under the Met Council guidelines?
Let me think now. If it's 80%,
Mayor, they're from way up north.
Senator Olson. Yes.
Okay. All right. I understand. Is anybody from the Met Council here? I need some support. I think it's 80% of the 30% of income.
Ms. Nolan, can you help us?
Mr. Chair and members, Patricia Nauman with Metro Cities. I believe that is correct. It's 80% is considered affordable by Met Council guidelines.
80% of
80%. 80% of median income metro area. Oh, double okay. check it.
Oh, so it's 80% of the median income in the metropolitan area.
And at 30%, I believe it's 30% of the 80% of the 30% of your income.
Okay.
And, of course, our income is lower than the median, which with our number of multifamily housing is draws from a very large area, affordable people who need mm-hmm. the affordable housing.
And so let me understand that. So these people are paying 30% of their income for their housing?
Yes, sir. 80, yes.
Thank you.
We also have Section 8 housing, which is a part of that mix.
Well, Mr. Mayor and Senator Olson, you heard me tell Senator Metzen that, you know, we are working on a formula. We understand that there are problems with assessing needs with the current small cities formula. We have had some discussions last year about a different formula. They're kind of ongoing. In the next couple years, we are expecting to have a redo of the LGA formula and including work on the small cities formula. It's really good to know about these examples that are not being met, so we'll see what we can do. I can't say anything for this year, but we certainly are glad you're here today. Anything else, Senator Bach? Well,
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mayor, what did your LGA look like prior to 2003? Had it been declining, or was it a stable number, or growing, or? Because I mentioned that because in 2003, let me just say it, the governor thrust upon the legislature some significant changes in the LGA formula that have created some burdens for cities, especially smaller cities. I've been unable at this point at least to, I think fixing that to some degree is going to take some money to do that, and it's kind of a compounding factor of the fact I think he took about $170 million or so out of the formula and then made changes in the formula at the same time, and we're seeing a growing number of cities kind of in your situation. So I just was curious, prior to 2003, if you started experiencing problems before that or if it's been after 2003.
What interesting...
Mayor Real.
Mr. Chair. Sorry. Mr. Chair and Senator Bach. The change in the formula really drove a significant change in the dynamics in our community because of our joint powers policing. When the changes occurred, the formula for our policing services was based primarily on a negotiated basis, but based primarily on demand for services. That means responding to medicals, and so on. Because of the nature of the city, our formula required our paying 29.5% of the police budget, when in fact our tax capacity as a percentage of the whole in our policing district was 14%. When Excelsior experienced the reduction in LGA, significant reduction over a two-year period, we challenged our neighbors and said, look, we're going to have a real hard time funding this. It led to some significant disagreements in terms of changing the funding formula, resulting in almost losing our JPA. Instead, we were able to get people to go to binding arbitration. Out of that binding arbitration, we only had relief of about 2.5%. So Excelsior is paying right now 27%, and we have 14.5% of the tax capacity as a percentage of the whole. That translates to $221,000 extra that Excelsior is paying because of our service. In addition to that, we have a park that's 13.5 acres that happens to be on Lake Minnetonka, and it is a regional draw. And that park, net of our parking revenues, costs us about $130,000 a year. We have facilities, we have lifeguards, we have upkeep, and so on. And so even if we just put half of that against the, you know, a regional and the city absorbed the other half, that's another $65,000. That's over $286,000 without considering the road conditions in Excelsior, which have had very little attention over 60 years, 70 years, 80 years. And we have we studied our pavement management last year. We have a pavement management study that suggests over $4 million of roads that need to be completed. And when you look at the other infrastructure issues, we did a rate and fee study last year because we needed to make sure that we were charging adequately and appropriately. We are at the upper end of reasonable on our fees. And so we're at that point. That's why I call it the perfect storm here. With the funding formulas that came, LGA funding formula that came last year, it was looked like a downward trend. And then, not looked like, it was going to be. And then a funding formula that was proposed in a letter I received about 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks ago by one of the northern cities to redo the funding formula. We were looking at, under their formula that they were going to propose, we looked also at losing additional dollars. That last year, I met with Representative Burns and talked about some relief, and the idea was, well, we're probably not going to see any change, and it didn't happen. And then this year, when we started to look at it again, I got very nervous, and I said, I can't wait any longer. The funding formulas that have heretofore come keep us on the downward trend, and we need to make a case for Excelsior, a very, very unique case, which I characterize as the perfect storm here. So I talked to Representative Burns and Senator Olson, and they said, you know, this is a unique case. Let's make a case, and that's why we're here today. So thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Real. And the bill is requesting an increase of $250,000. Do you recall? I think in response to Senator Bach's question, you did lose your LGA from 03 and 04 during.
Yes, that was.
And how much was that?
That was a $242,000
reduction in those.
No, the reduction was $135,000.
135.
Yes. And so that's on this that's on this sheet.
What do they currently get around?
107.
I'd be happy to provide additional information as needed or requested.
Yeah, Mr. Mayor, currently you're getting 107.
107, that's correct.
And you're requesting 200. You had $135,000.
And it was at 242.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any more questions, members? Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Senator Olson. We'll appreciate your testimony, and we'll see what we can do. We'll take a look at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Tough year, but as the, you know, make sure that as the formula change committees are working, that we would appreciate your input into that also as this goes along in the next couple of years.
Mr. Chairman, I'd love to be back on tax committee, not have it separated from the education as it was.
Thank you very much. Back to Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 3566 modifies the standard for the maximum limitation on abatements. Under current law, the maximum limitation is 10% of the current levy of the political subdivision. What this bill would do is measure that as the minimum, the maximum limitation as a 10% of net tax capacity. believing that, largely believe this will create a more uniform standard by which we measure what level of maximum level of abatement should apply to political subdivisions. This is a change in law that would affect, of course, the entire state, but it comes out of our discussions during the conference committee last year regarding the interchange on 94, known to us as the Brockton interchange. And we know we all recall extensive discussion during the conference committee about how to resolve, at the time, that TIF proposal. And I think we got something that can work here and that also allows us to make a change statewide. I've got with me today former Representative and Commissioner Kevin Goodnow, who can give us a little bit of that history and tell us how this can apply in the city of Dayton.
Welcome to the division.
Thank you, Mr. Goodnow. Chairman, members of the division. My name is Kevin Goodnow. I'm here representing the Hasson Main Street LLC, a developer that is working with the city of Dayton. I just want to give you a little bit of information about history about how we went from last year's discussion on the bill to where we're at today. After hearing the concerns of committee members, especially on the conference committee last year, about the approach we were taking last year, I worked with some of the people that had the biggest concerns about that approach to try to come up with a different alternative solution. And in looking at that, we looked at tax abatement, and we found that this is probably and what we discovered was something that really probably needed to be changed, a good public policy change, that would impact and help a number of medium-sized cities throughout the state in trying to increase their job capacity and their economic development. What we looked at is tax abatement, and what we found was that this would work except for the limits that were put into place. The limits are currently capped by the 10% of the net tax levy, or $200,000 as a max. When you look at cities throughout the state, their tax levy as compared to the net tax capacity can range anywhere from 0% to 300%. Mr. Chairman, you might be one of the few members in the legislature that knows where the city at 0% is at Funkley, Minnesota. But at 300% is in Neillsville, which isn't very far away from Funkley either. Now, those cities won't be impacted by this change because they would be impacted by the $200,000 cap. But for those cities that are bigger, there's even a range there as well. The range goes from anywhere in the 8% range to in the low teens for Delwood or Deep Haven to the 70% range in Hibbing and Montevideo. So really, when you look at the way the limits or caps are put into place currently, it really depends on the tax levy for that local community. And what we're looking at here is making that change to net tax capacity so it's standardized throughout the state. And therefore, you're treating cities similarly situated with regard to tax capacity in similar ways. So that's really the nexus of the bill. It provides additional tools to local governments to look at economic development. How and if they use this tool to bring in economic development, it will still be left up to those public institutions. But that is the only change we're making is on the cap itself. And with us, we also have Samantha Arduino.
Arduino, thank you, Mr. Chair, Goodnow. Members of the committee. My name is Samantha Arduino, and I'm the city administrator for the city of Dayton. And I'd like to express our support for this bill, along with the League of Minnesota Cities support and Metro Cities, who also are present here and support this bill. This bill would do exactly what has been said. It would give us a development tool to maximize our limited resources so that we can participate more in some of our economic development goals, the regional goals that we have in Northwest Hennepin County, especially along the I-94 corridor, but in terms of our economic development, where we would be limited by the current legislation at $200,000, this is going to give us an additional fund which we could leverage for federal dollars, for programs, with private sector money, so that we can accomplish some of our local goals, but also regional goals as well. So we would like to certainly impart to you our strong support for this bill, and thank you very much for the opportunity to express that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions, members? Senator Bach.
Commissioner Goodnow, what city of Dayton additional money does it allow them to capture for the interchange project if we do this law change? Because in the future, they capture 10% of new tax capacity that's built. Is this a pretty big change for Dayton?
Mr. Goodnow.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Buck, currently the city of Dayton's, based on information I received from the League of Cities, their city tax rate is at 44% of of their tax capacity. So this would, in essence, double their ability, double the amount of money that they could use for tax abatement. They have a $5.5 million total tax capacity right now. So goes from $500,000 to about, I would say, $1 million. I think I have that right.
So, Mr. Goodnow, did I hear you say an additional $500,000 of abatement?
Mr. Chairman, that would be correct.
The first year.
That would be for first year. The way it's currently set up. Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
Senator Bach, or members of the division, Senator Bach, I guess right now. And again, this will put cities in the same situation throughout the state on the same playing field. So, rather than looking for something specific for Dayton, we're looking for something that will impact cities of like Dayton equally throughout the state. The cities that will be most impacted will be medium-sized cities that have tax capacities of $2 million or more.
I was going to ask Mr. Paulson, but maybe you know Mr. Goodnow. Do you know, does this have any interaction with the city's aides? Mr. Paulson? We're on Senate File 3566,
Mr.
the
Chairman,
limitation on abatements.
The question is whether the abatements would affect the city's aides?
Yes.
There should be no direct effect.
No direct effect. Thank you.
Senator
Bach.
Chairman, Mr. Paulson, if they, I don't understand how that works. If they capture 10% of their tax capacity and don't count it, wouldn't that have some impact? Or does it still get counted for aid purposes even though they've abated it?
Mr. Paulson.
It makes a community look, from a tax capacity standpoint, look poor.
Mr. Chairman, I guess that's true. That to the extent that it's not included in the, excuse me, in the general tax base, there could be some effect from that. Yes.
Thank you. Anything else, members? Anything else, Senator Larson? Well, Senator Larson, I think this is a candidate for a possible amendment in the full committee. So we'll take mm-hmm. this one along with. With the property tax article.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Mayor, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We are going to move to some discussion of the Green Acres language. We have been working since last year and longer on changes and updates to the Green Acres. We have had the legislative auditor's report that informed us that there was a fair amount of tax shifting going on as a result of Green Acres, and also a fair amount of non-ag land that was being sheltered from tax. So we have in our property tax article some Green Acres changes, and I'm just in the process of looking through them. And Ms. Zoff, could you walk us through the Green Acres changes, please?
Do you want me to do the whole property tax?
Should we
article?
Do the whole property tax article?
Well, it's kind of woven in there.
We'll do that in conjunction with the whole property tax article.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members, you have two articles before you, and I'll start with the one that's labeled property taxes. Section 1 is a provision that would make the non-commercial seasonal recreational property subject to referendums. This is a provision that was in last year's Senate bill, and it coordinates with the removal of those properties from the state general tax that's also in this. Section 2 is the beginning of the Green Acres provisions. And in this section, we're just making one change, and that is with respect to the qualifications of nursery or greenhouse properties for Green Acres treatments. And this would limit that so that only acreage that's actually used to grow nursery stock would be subject to the Green Acres treatment. Section 3 is another Green Acres amendment. That removes the existing income qualification from Green Acres treatment, but instead would impose a different kind of income requirement just for properties that consist of between 10 and 20 acres. Properties of less than 10 acres don't qualify for Green Acres, but if the property is between 10 and 20, then the income test would be as stated on the top of page 3. And this is the same income test that was in last year's Senate tax bill. Section 4 is, and then I should also add, in addition to the new income test for those smaller parcels, looking beginning on page 3 at line 11, it modifies the qualifications for including wasteland and woodland in the Green Acres parcel. They would not be subject to Green Acres treatment unless they were either used for agricultural production purposes or it's very difficult for the assessor to separate the value of that part of the property from the value of the production acreage.
Ms. Tom, so what I think is going on here, and just so that people listening know what's going on, we are reducing the acres that are eligible to Green Acres to be just productive ag land or pasture ag land, so that a lot of the wasteland that there is no longer going to qualify for Green Acres. Some of these smaller parcels that have been hard to define as to whether they're agriculture or not are going to be subject to this income criteria that we have in here. And so hopefully that will clear up some of that confusion. Now, Ms. Zoff, on line 5, page 3, the Schedule F, from my recollections, we are going to be asking people applying for Green Acres to have a Schedule F to demonstrate farm income or a Schedule E, or I'm sorry, on line 8 through 10.
Right.
And that is for all applicants for Green Acres, not just the small parcels?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, the way this is drafted right now would only require the evidence from the smaller parcels.
Okay. Well, members, committee, this is something that we've been working on for a long time, and there might still be some little adjustments that we make, and that might be one of them. So, thank you, Ms. Soff.
Mr. Chairman, we did do that on Section 4. That's intended to be a part of the application so that the applicant would have to at least supply a copy of the Schedule F or Schedule E that shows farm rental income. There isn't a particular income limit or expenditure requirement there, but they would have to demonstrate that they had that some sort of farm income with the application. Section 5 is another Green Acres provision. This was in the Senate bill last year, and it provides that typically under Green Acres, the property may defer the payment of special assessments, but this would provide that special assessments by a watershed district would not be eligible for this deferment. And this would apply either to special assessments that are levied in the future for all Green Acres participants, or for those who just apply for Green Acres in the future, it would apply to watershed district assessments whenever they were imposed, so that the applicant would have notice of that coming in.
Members and public, what my thought is there is that if your ag land, managing the water on that land is critical to whether you are able to produce a crop or not, and the watershed districts are the organization that manages that water. So I think it's important that those special assessments remain with the land. Ms. Soff.
Mr. Chairman, Section 6 on page 4 is a provision that was in, both 6 and 7 were in last year's Senate tax bill. 6 requires the Department of Revenue to determine a fair and uniform method for the determination of agricultural values for agricultural properties. Section 7 makes it explicit that the Green Acres program should apply statewide, beginning no later than assessments for taxes payable in 2010. Section 8 is a new provision that provides a tax credit for property that's located in bovine tuberculosis management zones. This would institute a state-paid property tax credit equal to the tax paid on the parcel where the herd has been located if the parcel is located in, a part of it is located in a bovine tuberculosis management zone and the owner has eradicated a cattle herd that had been kept on that land, and this would be in order to prevent the beginning or the spreading of bovine tuberculosis.
Members, as Ms. Soff said, this is a new provision. In Minnesota, we have a serious issue in the animal agriculture sector, particularly the cattle and dairy industry, in that we lost accreditation with regard to bovine TB, which is going to require extensive testing and costs and inability to ship animals out of our state. In order to get back to bovine TB free status, we have to do all that we can to reduce the interface between cattle and animals in the area that has been identified as having bovine TB. I do have a bill in Ag Committee this afternoon that is proposing a herd buyout in these areas. It's very controversial and unpopular. What this credit is an effort to provide some assistance to those farmers that are going to have to go through this herd buyout. So that's the rationale for including this provision in the article at this time. Ms. Soff?
And it does provide in that section that the state will reimburse the local units of government for the property tax revenue that is lost, and the credit will terminate after the date when the Board of Animal Health has certified that the state is free of bovine tuberculosis. Section 9 is a provision that was also in last year's Senate tax bill, and this has to do with borrowing in a homestead where there's a piece of property that includes both a homestead and an area that's used for non-homestead purposes. Under this provision, the value that's attributable to the homestead part of the property, or $76,000, and it would be the greater of those two, would be able to be valued or assessed as a homestead. This wouldn't apply to buildings that contain fewer than 4 residential units. This is kind of a resurrection of an earlier law that had been phased out several years ago, but this would reinstate the law that had been in effect prior to that phase out. Section 10 is the amendment to the agricultural land and other Class 2 classifications.
Mm-hmm. I'd interrupt Ms. Soff for a minute. Members, when you're thinking about what's going on with regard to agriculture, Green Acres, and classification, what I'd like you to keep in your mind that the first step is to receive the classification agriculture. After that, you go and do your Green Acres application. These changes that we're talking about here in Section 10 and beyond dealing with the classification changes, the earlier provisions are the Green Acres changes, and they are separate. So if we can kind of keep that straight, because I've had struggled with some of the confusions myself as I've thought about this. Thank you, Ms. Saw.
On page 6, line 26, there's a reduction in the class rate that applies to the ag homestead property from 0.55% to 0.5%. And the language is stricken beginning on page 6, line 31, and then including the new language at the top of page 7 and throughout a series of other changes here. is a restatement of the new classification for vacant rural land that was in last year's tax bill in the Senate, on the Senate side. Let's see. We also expand the types of state or federal conservation programs that would apply if land is enrolled in programs other than the RIM program or the CRP program. The land would also be qualified to be considered as agricultural if it had been classified as agricultural prior to its enrollment in these programs. The bottom.
To that point, I think that at that point we should say that while they will qualify as the ag classification, they wouldn't qualify for green acres.
Right.
Thank you.
And we might need to make that explicit, but I think we'll get there. Yeah.
Okay.
Bottom of page 7 modifies the acreage requirements that apply to the ag classification again. There had been a provision that in general agricultural land was required to have at least 10 acres, but if a parcel had less than 10 acres, it had to be exclusively and intensively used for raising or cultivating agricultural products. This would increase that threshold to 20 acres and then establishes a list of qualifications in terms of the use of the property that hopefully would be somewhat more clear in terms of determining which of those smaller parcels would qualify for the agricultural classification. Page 8, line 29, includes short rotation woody crops in the list of trees that are included within the definition of agricultural products for the purpose of that classification. Section 11, which is on page 10, is the provision that had been in the first version of House File 3201 this year and was also in last year's vetoed bill, although modified here, and that would increase the class rate for personal property of utilities. Under this provision, page 10, line 24, that would change that class rate to 2.5% for taxes payable in 2009 and to 2.8% for taxes levied in 2010 and thereafter. Section 12 on page 11 includes changes that would eliminate the classification, the separate classification for seasonal recreational residential property. And this is also picked up from last year's tax bill. And the upshot is that the seasonal rec property will either be, if it's improved with a residential structure, it will be included in the non-homestead residential class. And if it's not improved, it will be in the new vacant rural land classification. Paragraph D on line, beginning on line 4, deals with the description of some resort property, and I will double check this. In the process of putting this draft together, we were amending provisions that had just been enacted last week, and I think this was in last week's bill, so that should not appear as new language, and we'll get that cleaned up. And that dealt with the classification, further description of resort property. And then as you go through pages 14, 15, the rest of that section just deals with the vacant rural land and seasonal rec classification changes. And the same with section 13. That is the kind of all other property classification. And in that section, we're pulling out property that would be classified as vacant rural land. Section 14 is the basically a technical amendment that describes the application of the bovine tuberculosis eradication credit to property tax statements. Section 15 on page 17 is the amendments to the state, begins with the amendments to the state general tax, And that is, as in last year's bill, to include, or to rather eliminate the application of the state general tax to seasonal recreational property. We also have modified the computation of that tax by beginning the dollar amount that's on page 17, line 9, is the sum of the levy that would have been imposed for taxes payable in 2009 plus the additional value that is brought in by the change in section 16, which would apply the state general tax to electric generation personal property. So the new tax base for that tax will be a combination of what the current tax had been plus this additional value, the tax on that additional value. Section 17 eliminates a reference to the state general tax as it applies to the seasonal rec property, and the repealer in section 19 is the repeal of the seasonal rec part of that tax. Section 18 requires the Commissioner of Revenue to study the valuation of agricultural property in the state and report to the tax committees by January of 2009.
Thank you, Ms. Soff. Mm-hmm. Questions? Should we move to the AIDS article?
Sure. The second article before the division this morning is the AIDS to Local Governments article. Section 1 is a provision, and much of the article here picks up the provisions that were in the Unity Bill that was presented to the committee or the division last week. Section 1 is the amendment to the city revenue need that provides a floor for that. That was part of the Unity Bill. Section 2 is the city aid base provision. If you go to page 4, the language that's stricken there, and this also comes from the Unity Bill, is the elimination of the regional center aid that's in current law. And section, the language on page 6, beginning on line 3, that is stricken, is replaced by the small city aid base that's in section 3. That, again, is similar to what was included in the Unity Bill with one difference, and that is that the aid is calculated using the population that is either the greatest of the city's highest federal census population since 1940 or its current population estimate. Section 4, the city jobs base, is a provision from the Unity Bill, and that's exactly as it was in that bill. Section 5 is a change in the computation of the county tax base equalization aid. And this is similar to a provision that had been in last year's Senate bill, but was not in the vetoed bill. But the factors that are used in paragraph B at the top of page 8 have been modified. So those were each increased somewhat from the level of the 2007 bill. The county transition aid provision in section 6 was included in the vetoed bill, and this would just provide that county transition aid, which was not in effect at all for 2008, would be reinstated as it had been in 2007 so that it would be at the level of one-third of the transition aid that each county received in 2005. Section 7 at the top of page 9 is a new provision, and that would provide an additional aid of $500,000 per year to any county in which the percentage of households that receive food stamps divided by its age-adjusted population is greater than 5%. And the aid is intended to be used to meet the county's cost of out-of-home placement programs. Section 8 is an aid to townships, an increase in the aid to townships, and this provision had been included in last year's vetoed bill. Section 9 is the city formula aid that is taken from the Unity bill. Section 10 as well is basically taken from the Unity bill, but I would point out that this is a provision that had been amended in the bill that was enacted last week to incorporate the volatility factor, Under the Unity Bill, that factor would not be necessary, so the new language has been stricken, and the language from the Unity Bill dealing with the amounts of aid increases and decreases, the floors and the ceilings, is as it had been proposed in the Unity Bill. Section 11 is also from that bill. That has to do with a potential 2009 aid adjustment if the appropriation does not reach the level of $90 million. This specifies how the aids will be distributed for 2009 only. Section 12 is the provision which increases the appropriation for city LGA by $90 million. Section 13 is an aid to counties, and that was also included in last year's bill. It was a $30 million increase for aids to be payable to counties. And then the final provision, section 14 on page 13, is a provision that would require a study of aids to local governments with a group reporting to the legislature by the end of 2010.
Thank you, Ms. Soft. Questions? members and to the public, this is going to be offered as the property tax article and the tax bill. We certainly will have time to getting this out now so everybody has time to review it and prepare their thoughts for the full division. But is there anyone that would like to testify today on either of these articles? Seeing none?
Mr. Chairman, we've got to figure out between now and the end of the month how we're going to pay for it.
Well, Senator Bach, we're doing a good job of giving some aid to our local counties. I look forward to working in the full committee to figuring out how to pay for it. But, you know, as we hear all these property tax increase issues, this year I believe is going to be one of the hardest for our state's residents as their values are going down while their property taxes are going up. I think it's going to be extremely important that we're able to accomplish what we're setting out to do here. Nothing else, members? I think with that we'll lay these articles aside for inclusion. And we're done with all the bills. We're down to the 4D housing report. Mr. Folkman. And Mr. Austin, how am I doing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Gordon Folkman, Director of the Property Tax Division.
And Mr. Folkman, I've got Mr. May on my list, too. Does he want to come up also?
Mr. May was going to be available if we were able to get to the report earlier in the session, or earlier in the committee hearing, but I think he had to leave. Okay. And he was going to be available in case there were just any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Folkman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Gordon Folkman, Director of the Property Tax Division, and we were asked to give to the committee today a brief summary of the 4D report that we did last year. Just a little bit of background, the legislature mandated several assessment classification reports back in 2005, and the report for the low-income 4D housing was one of those reports. We finished that report last year, but we didn't have a time last year to bring the report back to you and give you a summary of the findings and recommendations. So we're here today to give you that brief overview. And to my right is Larry Austin. Larry is our county rep for the metropolitan area counties, and he was also the lead person for the review and analysis of the 4D report. And I'll turn it over to Larry to walk the committee through the general findings and recommendations.
Mr. Austin.
Morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Larry Austin. I'm with the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. Before I go through the summary of the 4D report, if it's all right with you, I would like to recognize the people who are involved in the committee help put the report together. We had a working group that consisted of three assessors, Dwayne Ebbinghausen from Beltrami County, Tom May with Hennepin County.
Mr. Austin, just a second. Mr. Folkman, we don't have copies of the report.
Mr. Chair, members, I apologize. I just neglected to bring a copy. I have a copy here. I could have maybe an aide do an executive summary copy real quick for the committee. It is available on our website, but that's not going to help you today. Would that be possible? It wouldn't take long to get a copy of the executive summary.
Well, Mr. Folkman, just a second. Senator Bach, maybe what we should do is, I don't know how your schedule is.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's not a reason to hear this before we move the bill out, I don't believe,
no,
is there?
No, there's no reason.
Why don't we, maybe we should schedule some time after we move the bill out, which is tentatively March 27th?
Yeah.
And
I apologize. I just forgot to bring in a copy of the report.
Mr. Volkman, would that work okay if we did it, sometime after the 1st of April?
That would be fine with me.
I think it would be helpful if committee members had the report to go along with the testimony.
I didn't realize we didn't have a copy of the report, so I apologize. But let's schedule this for another time. Senator Ma, you're okay with that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, can I just ask Mr. Folkman whether or not there are any recommendations that you have that we need to act on, before we move out bills that would address that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wall, the main recommendation that came out of the report was to remove change that percentage threshold from 75% down to 20% for qualifying properties, and I think that was in the bill that was just passed.
Right.
So that recommendation was acted upon.
Well, then I think that it's appropriate that we make the time to get the report.
Well, Mr. Folkman, let's wait till after the we have a little more time and we have the report and we'll hear the report then. Is that okay?
That's fine. I apologize for just an oversight.
That's fine. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. We have no more work in front of the division, so we're adjourned.